This week on Vaticano, the Synod of Bishops of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church is convening in Rome from September the 3rd to the 13th. Sit down with the postulator for the Ulma family, a Polish Catholic family martyred during World War II for hiding Jews, and return to the Italian city of Bagnoregio for part two of our series as we uncover its Catholic history. Vaticano starts now. One month before the Catholic bishops come to Rome for the Synod on Synodality, 45 of 56 bishops of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, or UGCC, came to Rome to gather for their own synod from September the 3rd until September the 13th. The central theme of the synod is pastoral support for victims of war. Among the bishops who are participating in the Synod of Bishops of the UGCC are also four new bishops who were made bishops after the synod held in July of 2022 in Poland. The current head of the church since 2011 is Major Archbishop Sviatoslav Shevchuk. He said the world today wishes to hear about Ukraine, and it's through the voice of our church, and it's from Rome. May neither our heart nor our voice falter to accomplish this mission. The Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church celebrates liturgy in the Byzantine Rite. 4.3 million people belong to the church, most of them living in Ukraine, Poland, Canada, the United States, and South America. About 6% of Ukrainians belong to the Greek Catholic Church. At a time when Russia's attack on Ukraine is still ongoing, the participants of the Synod hope above all for a clear message from the Pope. In an audience with members of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Bishops' Conference, the Holy Father again pledged his support and called for an end to the deadly conflict. On board the plane taking him to Mongolia, Pope Francis announced August the 31st that he's preparing an apostolic letter on St. Thérèse of Lisieux to be published October the 15th. The pontiff made his statement while greeting the 70 journalists who were accompanying him for a four-day visit to Ulaanbaatar, the capital of Mongolia. During a general audience on June the 7th, Pope Francis announced that he was writing an apostolic letter on the patron saint of missions.
She was born 150 years ago, and on this anniversary, I intend to dedicate an apostolic letter to her.
That day in the morning, Pope Francis had prayed in St. Peter's Square before the relics of St. Thérèse of the Child Jesus. That afternoon, he left for Gemelli Hospital in Rome to undergo a laparotomy operation. The Bishop of Rome stressed that St. Thérèse lived devoted to God, forgetting about herself, loving and consoling Jesus, and interceding for the salvation of all. The 150th anniversary of her birth and the 100th anniversary of her beatification are celebrated this year. For the occasion, the Holy Father has granted a jubilee year in honor of St. Thérèse of the Child Jesus that will last until Sunday, January the 7th, 2024, and has the theme for trust and love, the last words of her autobiography, Story of a Soul. St. Thérèse of the Child Jesus, also known as the Little Flower, was a French discalced Carmelite nun. She was born in the city of Alençon on January 2, 1873, and she was declared a saint in 1925 by Pope Pius XI and proclaimed a Doctor of the Church on October 19, 1997 by St. John Paul II. St. Pius X considered her the greatest saint of modern times.
Hello and welcome to this week's Vaticano Updates, the most important news from Pope Francis and the Vatican. Pope Francis's prayer intention for the month of September is for people living on the margins. In his video message, the Holy Father asks how society has allowed throwaway culture to dominate our lives, our cities, our way of life. the Pope urged the faithful to stop making invisible those who are on the margins of society, whether it's due to poverty, addictions, mental illness, or disability. The leader of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church expressed great pain and concern at Pope Francis's video message to young Russian Catholics on August 25th. During this live video, the Holy Father said, "You are the heirs of the great Mother Russia. Carry on with it, and thank you. Thank you for your way of being and for being Russian." The Vatican spokesman said, "The Pope intended to encourage young people to preserve and promote what is positive in Russia's great cultural and spiritual heritage, and certainly not to glorify imperialistic logic and government personalities." St. Catherine Tekowitha teaches us to live in ordinary holiness and to confront the suffering of life with patience, Pope Francis said about the Native American saint in his ongoing series of talks on apostolic zeal. The Holy Father described the intense difficulties the saint faced and the way Catherine responded. He emphasized that patience is a great Christian virtue and is needed to be a good Christian. The Vatican confirmed the appointment of Father Robert Mark of the Eparchy of Phoenix as a new bishop of a Byzantine Catholic eparchy serving several Midwestern U.S. states. The Byzantine Catholic Church is known in canon law as an ecclesia particularis, or a particular church. While it is in full communion with the Holy See, it retains a distinct liturgical rite and custom. The Holy Father said, "We are called to act like Jesus and cannot be indifferent to the situations that lead people, especially adolescents, into drug addiction." Pope Francis said, "Behind every addiction there are concrete experiences, stories of loneliness and inequality, exclusion, lack of integration. Faced with these situations, we cannot be indifferent." The Pope underlined in his message that it is often teens and young adults who fall into addiction. He also lamented an increase in doping in the sports industry. Thank you for watching this week's Vaticano. Updates, Matthew Santucci for EWTN Vaticano.
In a few moments, we'll be back with more on Vaticano.
May the dark clouds of war be dispelled, swept away by the firm desire for a universal fraternity where intentions are resolved through encounter and dialogue, and the fundamental rights of all people are guaranteed.
Pope Francis, on Monday, September the 4th, wrapped up a historic trip to Mongolia, where he became the first pope to travel to the world's most sparsely populated sovereign country. His visit lasted from August the 31st to September the 4th. Mongolia is one of the world's largest landlocked nations, sharing borders with much larger and more powerful neighbors, China and Russia. It has one of the smallest Christian communities in the world, with 1,450 Catholics in a country that is mostly Buddhist in a population of 3.3 million people. The Holy Father hailed Mongolia as a symbol of religious freedom. While the Catholic population in Mongolia is one of the smallest in the world, being little is not a problem, Pope Francis assured local missionaries, because God can accomplish great things with small numbers.
God loves littleness, and through it, He loves to accomplish great things, as Mary herself bears witness.
The Vatican's diplomatic contacts with Mongolia date back nearly 800 years. During the trip, Pope Francis recalled how Friar John of Pian del Carpine visited the third Mongol emperor, Guyug, in 1246 as an envoy of the Pope and presented to the Grand Khan an official missive from Pope Innocent IV. Pope Francis presented a copy of this historic document as a gift to Mongolia's leaders, as a sign of an ancient friendship that's growing and being renewed. The primary purpose of Pope Francis's trip was to visit the tiny Catholic community.
I am pleased that this community, however small and discreet, shares with enthusiasm and commitment in the country's process of growth by spreading the culture of solidarity, the culture of universal respect, and the culture of interreligious dialogue, and by working for justice, peace, and social harmony.
He ended his five-day mission on September the 4th with a stop to inaugurate the House of Mercy, which provides health care to the most needy in the Mongolian capital, as well as to the homeless, victims of domestic abuse, and migrants.
To truly do good, goodness of heart is essential, a commitment to seeking what is best for others. Commitment for the sake of remuneration is not true love. Only love can overcome selfishness and keep this world going.
At the end of Holy Mass on Sunday, September the 3rd, the Holy Father sent greetings to China and asked Catholics in China to be good Christians and good citizens. Mongolia was a part of China until 1921, and the Holy Father's apostolic trip was dotted by allusions to China. During the Holy Mass on Sunday, September the 3rd, at the Steppe Arena in the capital of Ulaanbaatar, Pope Francis explained to the faithful how to truly save their lives by placing their faith in Christ.
You need not be famous, rich, or powerful to be happy. No, only love satisfies our heart's thirst. Only love heals our wounds. Only love brings us true joy. This is the way that Jesus taught us. This is the path that he opened up before us.
Discover the remarkable story of Josef and Victoria Ulma, who attempted to rescue Polish Jewish families by hiding them in their own home during the Holocaust. They and their children were summarily executed on the 24th of March, 1944, for doing so. They demonstrated unwavering devotion to their Catholic faith and the sanctity of human life. Their story is one of parental love, moral courage, and a profound commitment to helping those in need. In this interview, we delve into the compelling story of the Ulma family, a testament to faith, sacrifice, and resilience. Joining us is Father Witold Burda, the postulator for the Ulma family's cause for beatification.
Good morning, Don Burda. It's a pleasure to have you with us today. I wanted to ask if you could start by giving us a brief overview of the family and how their story has shaped their cause for beatification.
Josef and Victoria were born in Markova, and both of them grew up in Catholic families. Therefore, they received a beautiful and deep Catholic education. They were very involved in parish life. They later got married. Josef was 12 years older than Victoria. On July the 7th, 1935, before the outbreak of the Second World War, they welcomed their first three children, Stanisława, Barbara, and Władysław. Then, after the outbreak of the Second World War, they continued to receive, with great love and gratitude to the Lord, the giver of life, three more children. On the day of their death as martyrs, Victoria was expecting their seventh child. She was already in an advanced stage of pregnancy. Furthermore, in terms of their parenting style, there's a beautiful testimony from the godmother of their third child, who said that for a week after the birth of that child, she stayed at the Ulma's house and saw Josef. Because Victoria was still weak after giving birth, every evening Josef would kneel down with the children and say their prayers. So the type of education their parents provided, for example, the best way to transmit the most important values, including, of course, the gift of faith in Christ, was through their life, lived in mutual respect and in an atmosphere of faith. They also demonstrated the importance of recognizing and addressing the needs of other people, whom they willingly helped. When they were faced with this great test, when eight Jews persecuted by the German occupiers knocked on their door, and they had to decide which side to take, either on the side of the unjust laws of the German occupiers who punished any help given to the Jews, or on the side of humanity, since the Germans aimed to eliminate the entire Jewish population of the European continent. The Ulma family chose to stand with the persecuted people. In doing so, they defended their dignity and once again affirmed the value of every person's life and dignity, regardless of gender or education, because each of us is created in the image and likeness of God.
And so to that end, I just wanted to ask you, how did you get personally involved with this cause for canonization, and what does it mean for you on a very personal level?
For me personally, the gift of working as a postulator and being involved in the cause for the beatification of the Ulma family is not by chance. I use the term service as a postulator. And this gift of working on their beatification cause is a great opportunity and a significant occasion to deepen my personal spiritual friendship with the future blesseds. It helps me understand more and more every day how important and beautiful it is to live each day according to the gospel, and how daily living according to the gospel's demands is not a burden, but an opportunity to grow, to become increasingly available, open, and mature, just as the Ulma family lived their lives. Among all the officials of the Congregation for the Causes of Saints, starting with the Cardinal Prefect, and many other people I've had the chance to meet and interact with, when discussing the life and martyrdom of the Ulma family, they always did so with great respect and attention. For example, as the current Cardinal Prefect of the Congregation for the Causes of Saints describes martyrdom in general, with a particular reference to the Ulma family, he defines it as the pinnacle, the highest form of holiness.
In December 2022, the Holy Father signed the decree recognizing the martyrdom of the family. And so for the first time in the history of the Church, this will be when an entire family will be recognized, will be beatified rather, and also the first time in the history of the Church when an unborn child will be beatified, which is, of course, is an incredibly historic moment. So could you speak a little bit to the importance of that, both for the Church and for their cause?
Indeed, it's a unique aspect of this beatification that the unborn child, still in the womb without a name, will be proclaimed blessed as a martyr. This child has reached the pinnacle of holiness. We do not know the child's gender, but through this gesture and the decision of the Holy Father, it emphasizes the Church's teaching that life is sacred, from conception to natural death.
Fino alla morte naturale.
We'll be back after a short break with more on Vaticano. Saint Bonaventure of Bagnoregio, one of the greatest intellectual figures of the 13th century, lived during a time marked by political, social, and ecclesial developments that challenged the prevailing attitudes and structures within the Church. Responding to these changing dynamics required the development of a renewed spirit and the ability to confront adversity with dialogue and make order out of chaos.
Il genio di Bonaventura specificamente è stato proprio quello di
Bonaventure's genius was precisely that of elaborating Franciscan spirituality, living it first for him, because he is a great saint, and also to systematize it in appropriate theological forms so that it would derive from it a useful doctrine for the entire Christian world, as well as for the religious order of friars.
Oltre che per l'ordine religioso dei frati.
Born in 1217 in Civita di Bagnoregio as Giovanni Fidanza, from a young age he was known for his erudition, curiosity, as well as his incredible piety. But he was plagued by illness. His mother prayed for the intercession of Saint Francis, and Bonaventure was miraculously healed, to which she exclaimed, "O Buonaventura, O what good fortune!" In the Leggenda Maior, Bonaventure's definitive biography on the life of St. Francis, he recalls the importance of this moment. "I was also obliged by the devotion I have towards the Venerable Father. During my childhood, in fact, I remember him as it was now. Thanks to his invocation and his merits, I was snatched from the jaws of death. It was against the backdrop of this miraculous intercession that Bonaventure cultivated a deep Franciscan spirituality and dedicated his life to God. At the age of 18, he left Bagno Reggio and set off to study in Paris, the intellectual hub of Europe. Yet he found a tense academic and ecclesial environment.
Allora, qual era il problema di fondo dell'università?
What was the underlying problem at the University of Paris? The mendicant orders, the Franciscans, the Dominicans, these dynamic orders had entered city life and therefore also the university, inevitably modifying the existing balances, and we know that when the existing balances are changed, it takes some time to find a new balance. The fact that the Franciscans and the Dominicans brought this new ideal of poverty, which was extremely interesting, struck, let's say, the imagination because it went against the idea of a rich and corrupt church and caused many students to go from the seculars to Franciscans and Dominicans. This success of the mendicant orders naturally creates envy, creates opposition. As always happens, this is normal in man.
Opposizioni, come sempre succede, questo è normale nell'uomo, no?
Bonaventure's university career was cut short. On February the 2nd, 1257, he was elected as the general minister of the order. Just as there were broader divisions between the mendicants and the secular priests, there were also internal divisions within the Franciscans that threatened not only the unity and survivability of the order, but also the very essence of Franciscan spirituality.
Una importanza enorme ha avuto il generalato, il governo.
The generalate, or the governance of San Bonaventure, which lasted for 17 years, which was very long, was of enormous importance, and he solved two great problems that undermined the unity of the friars. Undoubtedly, the first problem was that of the different interpretation of the rule of St. Francis, who was rigorous, the so-called spirituals, who instead was more open to tolerant conceptions, above all in matters of poverty and penance. And the second problem was precisely that of regulating the Franciscan ideal in a very balanced way, always proposing with great purity this very demanding and very radical ideal of evangelical life.
Ideale di vita evangelica molto esigente e molto radicale.
Underpinning Bonaventure's legacy as a theologian and legislator, reformer and mediator, is his Christocentrism. Christ is at the very center of time and history, of all order and harmony.
Ovviamente la centralità di Cristo, il cristocentrismo.
Obviously, there is the centrality of Christ, Christocentrism, and finally, his extraordinary work of spiritual growth, which is so important today, this itinerary in the mind to God, which means not only finding God, but also finding man himself. In a hermeneutical dynamic, we understand the difference between the cultural context in which Bonaventure worked with his thought and today, but we can grasp its great relevance because the principle highlighted was valid yesterday and is still valid today.
Il principio portato in evidenza valeva ieri e vale anche oggi.
Saint Bonaventure embodies the spirit of dialogue and continues to offer the Church guidance and a model of how to navigate differences.